Hello, 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 everybody. I have to say that I'm going to start off by saying that I'm utterly astonished by the maskless in real life audience for this talk, as I was by photos of stadiums filled with rugby fans in New Zealand. I mean, we've been in such a hole here in the U.S. for an entire year. The notion that there's another way of living and like that is just astonishing, although there are thousands of Americans who do that anyway, despite the COVID spreading around. Although I also have to say I'm feeling somewhat ADHD because I'm distracted by one of the Zoomers zooming in. They have a photo of Lenin on their bed. So there's that going on as well. I'll start off by saying that there's a fascist apocryphal that under Mussolini, the trains in Italy ran on time. And of course, despite its storm und drang, truth and such authoritarianism are rarely synonymous. Indeed, often quite the contrary to the ultimate collapse of both the state and the population health it bears responsibility for. The trains didn't run on time. Mussolini banned all reports of railway delays and accidents. Here in the United States, President Trump pushed much the same way against a different set of daily reports. Several times this past year, he spoke on the virtues of an epidemiological ignorance. When you test, you find something is wrong with people, he said. If we didn't do any testing, we would have very few cases. End quote. All to the tune of a half a million COVID-19 deaths in the richest country in the history of humanity. That doesn't mean, however, that the present political alternative is free of blame. One might justifiably sigh in relief at President Biden's election as the return of the adults. But are there adults in charge in a country without a national health service? Indeed, 40 years of neoliberalism neglected and monetized American public health, such as it was, spinning off such interventions down to the doctor-patient relationship, or only for those who can afford such hospital visits. For even under Obamacare, 28 million Americans are still without health insurance, and 44 million more are underinsured. Combined, that approaches three times the total population of Australia. I mean, can you imagine such a gap in public health coverage? I mean, without the capacity or interest, even now, in contact tracing and community health visits. So long before Trump, the U.S., despite its reputation, was in serious trouble upon any pandemic's eventual arrival. Such willful neglect across the globe extends back to the origins of this pandemic, along with, looking forward, the putative reset Capitol and its state representatives now propose. Despite the batch of new vaccines to which very few worldwide have access, SARS-CoV-2, the coronavirus behind COVID-19, remains on the march. It's still infecting hundreds of thousands of people a day the world over. In countries that handle the outbreak badly, among them the U.S., Britain, and Brazil, government rhetoric had at times even suggested letting the virus largely run its course. With little scientific backing, it was bandied that a mythical herd immunity, leaving perhaps millions dead in its wake, would save us. Agribusiness likewise proclaimed that the industry that helped set loose many of this century's deadly outbreaks worldwide offers exactly the right path forward. So we have the likes of the Animal Agriculture Alliance and the Breakthrough Institute. I think it's a version of the Institute in Australia. And they say that agricultural biosecurity, technology, and economies of scale, bigger is better, are the only way to protect us from another pandemic. Never mind that agribusiness production and land grabs conducted in its name are documented to have driven the emergence of multiple pathogens the past two decades. So how do we arrive at a historical moment when the very causes of the ongoing crisis are repeatedly presented as its solution? Modern agriculture emerged hand in hoof with capitalism, the global slave trade, and science. Early European powers deployed the first imperial scientists to decode the new landscapes and peoples their ships encountered on their voyages of conquest. Imperial science also helped recode these lands and peoples back into subjects for capital accumulation. From Europe and Africa, the various stages of capitalism that followed expanded across the Americas, the Caucasus, and the tropics, turning locally tended food landscapes into export commodities. From 1700 to 2017, large-scale croplands and pasture expanded fivefold to 27 million square kilometers. The practice of industrializing livestock and crop production took off to new heights after the Second World War. So I compressed the entirety of history of agriculture in short order. But for our purposes, we see for now that 40% of Earth's ice-free surface is now dedicated to agriculture and represents the planet's largest biome. Many millions more hectares are to be brought into production by 2050, especially in the global south, where what little virgin farmland remains to be cut out of the last of the rainforests and savannas. The poultry and livestock alive today represent 72% of global animal biomass, far surpassing the total biomass of vertebrate wildlife. Industrialized food animals are beginning to spread across the globe in veritable cities of pigs and chickens. What was once planet Earth has been turned into planet farm. These expansions are networked by circuits of capital and consumption. The circuits source an increasing volume of trade in live animals, produce, processed food, and germplasm. The growing patches of monoculture are characterized by declining diversity in animals and crops, as technical interventions select for a few genetic breeds over all the others. Varieties also are being lost as agricultural companies consolidate with each other. Such economically driven shifts have produced profound impacts upon both our ecology and public health. The production of limited lines of monogastric species, primarily pigs and poultry, is displacing locally adapted breeds of a wide array of animals across non-industrial countries. Similar trends are found in crops feeding both human populations and industrial livestock. Along agricultural's advance, primary natural habitat and non-human populations are contracting at record rates, destroying indigenous and smallholder land and livelihoods along the way. Deforestation and development are increasing the rate and taxonomic scope of pathogen spillover from wildlife to food animals and the laborers who tend them. COVID-19 represents only one of a series of novel pathogen strains who have suddenly emerged or reemerged in the 21st century as threats to humanity. These outbreaks, even in swine influenza, Ebola, Macona, Q fever, Zika, among many others, have all been tied to changes in production or land use associated with intensive agriculture, as well as logging and mining. Now, pathogens emerge differently depending on the place and commodity, but all are connected within the same web of environmental damage and global expropriation, which explains the cross-continental nature of the new pathogens. So we have SARS in China, MERS in the Middle East, Zika in Brazil, H5NX in Europe, swine flu H1N1 in North America. Now, how does production drive these outbreaks? At one end of a region's commodity chain, the diverse complexity of primary forests typically bottles up wild pathogens. Potential hosts are irregularly encountered, but transnational logging, mining, and intensive agriculture change these dynamics. They drastically streamline that natural complexity. While many pathogens on such neoliberal frontiers die off along with their host species, a subset of infections that once burned out relatively quickly in the forest can suddenly propagate much more widely. Ebola offers a classic example. Since the mid-1970s, Ebola outbreaks typically besieged a sub-Saharan village or two before dying out. And it's a terrible thing. You have 90% case fatality rates, but it comes in, kills both human and perhaps troops of gorilla, and then it burns out. But in 2013 to 2015, the Makona strain emerged along a frontier of monoculture oil palm and other crops out of an increasingly expropriated and globalized West African landscape. Although little differentiated in its genetics or clinical course compared to previous Ebola outbreaks, the Makona strain would go on to infect 35,000 people, killing 11,000 people, many of them living in major cities, and suddenly only a flight away from the rest of the world. It's less about the virus than its new context. So the scope of the context in which the virus emerges has shifted in a way that allows previous pathogens that have been marginalized to suddenly become find exactly their context that works best for them for spreading human to human. Now, other diseases emerge at the other end of the production chain. So Ebola emerges more out where the forest meets the peri-urban edge. But we have also deadly and human-adapted avian and swine influenzas that are typically cropping up in intensive operations located closer to major cities in the global north and south. Of the 39 documented transitions from low to high deadliness in avian influenzas from 1959 onwards, all but two occurred in commercial poultry operations, typically of tens or hundreds of thousands of birds. Intensive operations are so inundated with circulating avian and swine influenza that they now serve as their own reservoirs for new strains. So you can't just blame the wild waterfowl, as many an industry scientist does, as being the source of the new types of influenzas. Those influenzas are circling well on their way among the industrial poultry. So what is it about industrial farms that makes them breed such infections? Industrial turkeys are grown in barns of up to 15,000 birds. Industrial layers, those are hens that lay eggs, are stocked in barns of up to 250,000 birds. Growing animals in vast monocultures removes the immune firebreaks that would ordinarily cut off outbreaks in more diverse populations of birds. Pathogens routinely evolve around the now commonplace host immune genotypes of the industrial livestock. Overcrowding and poor hygiene induce intense stress in such food animals, which can depress the immune response and make them more vulnerable to infection. Housing high concentrations of livestock and poultry rewards those strains that can burn through them the fastest. So if you're a badass of a strain, typically you cut yourself off by killing your host, so you can't get into the next strain, into the next host, because you killed your host too fast. But if all the birds are bunched in together, then the next host is right there. So that selects for strains that are replicating quickly to the transmission threshold to allow them to get into the next host and beat out those strains that aren't so deadly. Other things are going on that speak to the impact of the industrial system, the industrial model, the industrial economic model as it weighs in on the virus. Animals are now slaughtered at ever younger ages. So growing out chickens in only 6 weeks and pigs in 22 weeks may select for greater pathogen deadliness, including infections that are able to survive younger, more robust immune systems. That's not a good thing if we're worried about pathogens spilling over into humans. We don't want pathogens that can figure out robust, healthy immune systems. There's what's called all-in, all-out production. It's an attempt to control outbreaks by growing out livestock in batches. That may unwittingly select for an infection threshold that lines up with finishing times the industry sets for its herds and flocks. That is, successful strains evolve life histories that kill grown-out farm animals near slaughter when stock is most valuable to farmers. But so we can think of things by which maybe we can get out from underneath this, right? So let's say you have a barn of birds and you have a terrible infection, comes in, kills most of them, but there are a couple that are still standing. Maybe there's some quirk in their immune system that allows them to survive. Well, at least we can use them as, if they survive, to be the progenitors of the next generation, and that their immune resistance then can be part of the local landscape. Well, that we can't do that under industrial systems. There's no reproduction on site. All the breeding is done at the grandparent level, offshore, for kind of morphometric characteristics like fast growth and bigger breasts and things like that. But no industrial animals reproduce on site. So in effect, we've removed natural selection as an ecosystem service by which we could defend our livestock and poultry from circulating pathogens. So with no reproduction on site and breeding conducted offshore, livestock populations are unable to evolve the resistance to circulating pathogens. As survivors do not breed, they cannot pass on their resistance. Beyond the farm gate, the increasing distance that live animals are shipped country to country has expanded the diversity of the genetic segments that pathogens can exchange, increasing the rate and combinations over which diseases explore their evolutionary possibilities. The greater the variation in their genetics, the faster pathogens evolve. So while we are increasing the variation of the pathogens and the speed by which they evolve, we've reduced the variation within our animals. So we've handed over Darwin to the pathogens, and we've removed natural selection as a tool that we can use to protect our own livestock and poultry, and by extension, protect ourselves. So in short, in industrializing meat production, global agribusiness is also industrializing the pathogens that circulate among its livestock and poultry. So we got the two ends. We got the Ebola end near the forest. We've got the influenzas more near the city. COVID-19 origins are something of a mixture of these two ends of our circuits of production. Coronaviruses are hosted by bats around the world. But the strain that bats host in China appears to hit humans worse once it successfully jumps species. The environment in which these bats live has also changed in foundational ways. Upon its economic liberalization, post-Mao, China undertook the BRICS route of development, intent on feeding its own people with its own natural resources. Millions were pulled out of poverty. Millions were left behind. Pro or con in taking this course, Chinese agribusiness and an increasingly capitalized wild food sector cut into the landscape of Central and South China, where many of these bat populations are located. As with Ebola, the interfaces among the bats, livestock, wild food animals, farmers, and miners on this commodity frontier expanded, boosting the traffic of various SARS-like coronaviruses. There's also the issue of increasing pesticide applications in China at a scale far beyond the already drenched United States. And that may have reduced the insect populations that the bats feed on. And this may have increased the interface coronavirus hosts shared with human populations as bats expanded their foraging range looking for food. So with the wild foods and agricultural production lines increasing in extent and speed, many a SARS-like coronavirus that successfully spilled over into a food animal or into a human can now make its way in short order across the peri-urban landscape to regional capitals such as Wuhan before hopping on the global travel network. Now, it's really hard to become a celebrity pathogen like that. You know, it takes a lot of work. Not everybody gets to be a global star, so but it really speaks to the number of strains that are circulating. So you have all sorts of Ebola strains that are circulating, all sorts of coronavirus strains, obviously all those influenzas, Nipah virus strains, all sorts of strains that are circulating and experimenting. And in essence, we've helped allow these pathogens to set up millions of labs, as it were, as they experiment with the livestock and with the human immune system and in such a way to be able to line up a casual infection that may have spilled over and in the course of several years able to solve the immune system enough to become a global pandemic. So we are really playing with fire in that regard. Now, it all seems such a trap. It's terrible. It seems like a vicious cycle of circumstances. And the question is there anything we can do about it? And the answer is yes. Yes, there is. We first must reject the normal that brought us this mess. Growing food isn't about making objects. Food items aren't widgets. Agriculture must be turned from an industrial economy primarily back to something more like a natural economy. We must return to assimilating a respect for food's context, the soil, water, air, ecological matrix, and community well-being on which food and the people who eat it depend. To box out the deadliest of pathogens, we must preserve forests and wetland complexity, maintaining ecological buffers across bats, geese, other natural disease reservoirs, our food animals, and our communities. We must reintroduce agrobiodiversity into livestock and poultry to serve as an immunological firebreak against deadly pathogens, both on farms and across whole landscapes. We must return to letting livestock reproduce on site so that herds and flocks can protect themselves against pathogens in real time. Such interventions require restoring the locus of control to farmers in rural communities and away from agribusiness. Now, agribusiness isn't there about stripping landscapes to make a buck. And if it means producing a pathogen that kills a billion people, they'd be willing to do it. I mean, these are sociopaths and not in the medical sense, but really in the true notion of a system that is organized around producing maximum damage if it produces profit. And we have to be explicit about this. Otherwise, we allow a kind of things like green capitalism to get away with attempting to continue a system under the guise of fixing it. So in short, to keep the worst of outbreaks from emerging in the first place, we must turn to the kind of state planning that centers farmer autonomy, community socioeconomic resilience, circular economies, integrated cooperative supply networks, community land trusts, and reparations. And we must undo the deeply historical race, class, and gender trauma at the center of land grabbing and environmental alienation, extending back to the age of colonialism. On the world stage, we must end the unequal ecological exchange between global North and South. Healing the metabolic rift between ecology and economy that drives pathogen emergence and climate change at the heart of modern agriculture involves planting a different political philosophy into the land. Betting that agribusiness, the major source of the pandemic problem we start off with, will provide the solution is otherwise at best futile. We can do much better thinking and acting toward the ways of living that will allow humanity and population health their place on our planet. Thank you.